Thank the organizers for bringing me here. It's a pleasure to be here in Toronto. When I was asked to give this talk, I had a choice of different topics, many different topics, and as it so turns out, we are actually writing this work up in a little more, in a longer paper, and so I was motivated to bring this all back to mind. This is work we did quite a while ago, and I know that Nick has worked some on these issues, and so I thought it would be wonderful to bring this to you. In addition, we have done some new numerical and analytical calculations that explain the defect motion of these little dislocations that are moving here. So when you look at these pictures, you see dislocations moving around. When they, you see new ones being born, you also see a spiral here. Then you, if you think there's, if you, also the pattern looks very target-like, you know, it's when you start, when you look at this pattern here, it looks basically like a target which has these funny face jumps over here and has also this core motion. What you also see is when a dislocation comes into a compressed region, it speeds up. So this work is done with a group at Bayreuth, which is led by Werner Pesch, and at Cornell with Brendan Plubb and David Egoff. And the work was funded by the NSF through DMR. Okay, well, yesterday Günther already told you what Rayleigh-Bernard convection is, so this is what I will study. So you just see that the contrast on this project is not that good. You have a bottom plate, you have a top plate, you apply temperature difference, and the important number to remember is that there is a control parameter epsilon, which measures the distance above onset that you are, so how far strong you have driven the systems. So at epsilon equals zero, you get a bifurcation, a forward bifurcation to convection rolls, which are shown schematically here, and we can observe these with clever optical techniques, which I can explain if I'm asked later. So if you do a linear stability analysis of the convection rolls, what you find out is that you have a neutral curve. So above this, so here what's plotted is epsilon versus the wave number Q, and here's this green line is the neutral curve. So above this line, rolls can exist. And then if you do a stability analysis of these ideal parallel rolls, what we find out is that in this blue region, they're stable. And outside of it, we get a skewed varicose instability and oscillatory instability up here, and over here, cross-roll instability. Now, this was all done by Busse a long time ago, and this is actually the Busse balloon for the fluid that I'm investigating right now. And what I wanted to show here is another movie of spiral dynamics. So instead of just having the spiral off center like this, so where you, what you saw before was a spiral that was not stationary, here we have a stationary state. In other words, a totally stable rotating four-armed rotating spiral. We have four dislocations. These four dislocations go around on a circle. If I would show the movie longer, you would see they would go around on the circle. And then there are four bound dislocations in the center, and they do some kind of core dance in it. Now, we can also do this in numerical simulations of the Navier-Stokes equation. So this is a movie that I got from Werner. And come on. It's happening. Here we are. So this is a movie that I got from Werner. So he initialized his pseudo-spectral code, and he simulates the Overbeck-Wozniacki equation. And what you find out is, again, you get here, this is a case of a two-arm spiral. It just looks very much like the experiment. You have the spirals going around on a circuit, and it turns out that within the numerical simulations, the results are about within 10% of the experimental results. So if I have a two-arm spiral of this aspect ratio with this wave number, the result of the simulation is with better than 10% from the experimental results. So we basically can numerically simulate everything we see in the experiment. The difference is, as you can already see, the aspect ratio, actually this aspect ratio is also small, but in the numerics you're limited to a finite size aspect ratio. You can't get too large because then the code just runs too long. So what is a spiral? Well, as I said, you take a target pattern over here and you put in two dislocations. You put a dislocation out here. So the wave jumps, if you go around the face, jumps by 2 pi, we are losing one period. And in the middle, the same thing happens if you go around, the phase jumps by 2 pi. And so if you take these two dislocations, you put this together, then you get a what would we call a giant spiral. It's a large spiral wave, which is rotating. By the way, please interrupt me if you have any questions. So the experiment that we conducted, that Brendan had conducted, in that case, what we had is we were using compressed carbon dioxide gas, and with this we can make, it's the same with what has been used quite a long time from in the Aulis group also, and what you can do is you can make very shallow layers, so you can make large aspect ratio systems, and so what we decided is to make an experimental cell that simultaneously had six different aspect ratios in one experiment. And then we just did this experiment, and here what you see is that the largest cell 1, cell number 2, 3, and number 4, they all have targets, while in the smaller cells they're overcome by boundary conditions, and we get these Panin patterns. I should also mention the boundaries on these cells were stepped, which gives a very slight forcing, especially transient sideward forcing, which selects the circular symmetry. So when you increase the temperature difference, you select that circular symmetry, and then it just persists and stays around. The Prandtl number in this experiment is about 1.4, which gives, and the diffusion times, the vertical diffusion times are of the order of a second, which means you can actually look at adjustment of the pattern. Well, what do we know about these targets? There were very clear predictions on this, and the first one is that, and there have been also experiments also by the Aulis group before, and what we know is that the targets are unstable above a certain driving, so above a certain epsilon, the spirals are known to go off-center. That's called the targets are known to go off-center, so that's called the target instability. And what we also know is that, that should not be spirals, that should be targets, sorry. Targets select a wave number QT. So in other words, there's a preferred wave number, and I will explain where it comes from, where the targets would like to adjust to a preferred wave number, and when they have that wave number, they are happy. And what we can was also calculated by Newell, Passot, and others was that rods will travel in such a way as to adjust the wave number of this target pattern. And so what's important is that the selected wave number I will call, for targets I will call QT. The equation that was used to explain this phenomenon is a nonlinear phase diffusion equation, which was rigorously calculated from Navier-Stokes equation, and Terry is going to talk about this at length, so I will not spend too much time on it. And what's important is that there's this function B of Q, which kind of determines everything. This is the phase of your pattern, so this describes the bending, basically, of your pattern and the spacing of your pattern. U is a mean flow field. So in other words, when you take a roll pattern and you bend it, pressure gradients are generated that won't unbend the pattern. So you get a mean flow field, and so there's another equation for the mean flow field, which I skipped here because you're probably going to show the full glory. And what you can also do is when you take just ideal rolls, ideal straight rolls, and you perturb your pattern, then you can linearize this equation. You can get a linear phase diffusion equation, where you have a d parallel over here, you have two diffusion constants, d perpendicular and d parallel to the rolls. Now what you can show is that if you take these phase diffusion equations, then d parallel can be calculated by differentiating q times b with respect to q, and you find out that d perpendicular is given just by 1 over this tau of q times b of q itself. And the calculation then shows that targets select a wave number such that d perpendicular is 0. So this gives you then the wave number QT, which is the target selected wave number. So if I have a selected target, then d perpendicular is 0, which means b of q has to be 0. It has to be crossed through 0. Now, what you can also do is we all know that the Eckhaus instability, so this long wavelength modulational instability of a pattern, is given by t parallel. So what we know is that the growth rate of the Eckhaus instability is basically minus t parallel of q times k squared. And if we now select, for example, the target wave number qt, then what we can calculate, then we can calculate from the growth rate of the Eckhaus instability t parallel. And we have used that, yes? Should ask the specialist. Why is d perpendicular 0 as the selected wave number for the target? So if you work in cylindrical coordinates, he says, just repeat, and then what you find is the stationary solution is stationary. I mean, the solution is stationary at this condition. I don't know, that's how far I understand it, but it might be deeper than that. Right, this is exact, right. That coincides with that, but there's no logical connection as far as I know. Is there? Well, you can talk in your talk about it.
Yeah.
We can discuss this. But as far as I know, it just happens to be like this. It's the same like here that you... Right, without mean flow. Right, this is without mean flow, it coincides. Right, I mean, this equation, the space diffusion equation, was without mean flow. If we use concentric patterns, it turns out that mean flow is not that important anyway. This is true in any Prandtl number. Yes. Yes, sure. For patterns where the mean flow is not too strong. It's only for infinite Prandtl number. Yes, correct. No, you're right. Okay. So what you can do is that if you don't have this wave number QT, then what was calculated by Dury and Allen is you can calculate the frequency of a traveling wave of the waves that will try to adjust the target. So you go far away from the target core and you ask yourself, if the wave number is wrong, how would the rows travel in and outward and with what frequency if you don't have the right wave number? And so what you can do is, so you know what the frequency is, so this is the formula, and it's nice, you can relate this, the derivative of Q, of B with respect to Q, you can relate this to de Perel. So in other words, what you can do, de Perel was this function, you differentiate, you get these two terms, but because we are at the target wave number, so we expanded around the selected target wave number where we know that B of QT is zero, then what we can say that omega should be equal to de Perel times delta Q over R. So this means when I'm in the vicinity of the selected target wave number, my rows, and I'm just a little bit away, the rows will travel in such a way that by a mistuning, it's proportional to the mistuning of the wave number from this preferred wave number QT, and it will go like 1 over R. So the further away I am, the slower the frequency will be. And the prefactor is de Perel, which I can measure from the Eckhausen instability. If I have a numerical code that can tell me what de Perel is, which I get from the Eckhausen instability, then I can calculate the velocity. And this is what I have done over here. So the velocity of the traveling wave that tries to adjust the target around QT will be VR, and which will be proportional to some constant alpha, which is given just through the Eckhausen instability, so 2 times de Perel, and it's proportional to QT minus Q. It depends how far away I am from this target wave number, and it will also go proportional to 1 over the distance I'm away from the center of the target. Does that make sense? Now, this only works because this function B is approximately linear going through QT equals 0, and so the slope doesn't change much, so it actually works quite well even if you're further away from QT. So this is, okay, so what we have learned now is if we have a target, that the target is not quite on its selected wave number, the waves will travel as to adjust the wave number. It will either contract or expand to adjust the wave number, and the speed will be this. Okay, well then targets have other things. Targets have instabilities, and I just wanted to show you some movies of instabilities. So what happens is when you increase epsilon, the target goes off center, and that was also predicted from the same equations. And what happens, so here, for example, the movie's already running, and then I increase epsilon, so I increase suddenly epsilon, and the target very quickly responds and moves off center. And in this case, it moves off center and has this little blinker in the middle, and the state just sits there, and it starts to blink like this for hours. And of course, you can only also simulate this. So here, over here, we have the simulations by Werner, and basically it's similar parameters. It just looks a little funny because there's this moray pattern showing up, but what you also see is the target goes off center and then it blinks. Now, there are now two possibilities for this target. If I increase epsilon even further, there are two possibilities. One of them can be that the roll pattern breaks because it's too strongly compressed and it reaches the skewed varicose instability boundary. Or what the pattern can do, the pattern can annihilate this little blob in the middle. And by annihilating one roll pair in the middle, it can decrease its wave number and go back on center, and this is exactly what happens in certain situations. So let me just go here. So here, for example, this is a movie of this huge stay. It just sits there and it blinks, and then after a while, you just have to watch here. The rest is really boring, and it blinks, and blinks, and I should have sped up the movie a little bit. And then suddenly it disappears. And now if you would wait long enough, then this point would move back on center, and the target is again on center, and then you increase epsilon further, and then the target goes again off center. And then actually what happens is what's shown in the next movie, and I want to play it once, and then I will stop it. So this is already a movie running, and please watch up here. I will replay it in a moment. You see that there was suddenly the pattern pinched off, which is the skewed varicose instability, and it generates one dislocation and another dislocation. One goes to the center of the target, the other one stays on the outside, and now we have a target. So here, let me just stop it, if I catch it. Look, here. So what you see now here is it just tore. You see that the wave number is quite different here. Here's one dislocation, here's the opposite dislocation. One glides to the center, makes the spiral, and the other one just stays out there. Oops. Okay. Let's just watch it again. So right over here, it's going to happen. There it is. So this one now just glides in to the center and makes the one dislocation in the middle, which is the spiral, and the other dislocation stays out there and just goes around. Okay? So this is the other type of instability that we see in our experiment. There, because the phase is pinned because of the boundaries on the outside, so you can't move away from the boundaries. Like when Günter Ahlers and Yu-Chiu Hu did these experiments, their targets actually sometimes just got free from the boundaries, and then you got a crossroad instability and some other behavior. Pardon me? That's what I remember. So what you can do is you can measure the target wave, basically just the target wave number. So what you do is you just measure the wave number, the mean wave number of this target. And so this is for these four different cells. And so what you find is there seems to be a selected target wave number. The little jumps in the data are where there was one instability. So these are really targets that are only on center. So this one was on center, and then there something happens, then data is missing, and then the next one is on center again because it was unstable. But so this is when the thing started to blink, and then it jumped up to here, and then it came on center again and goes on. But in general, we have a line here, and if we compare this line, we fit to this line the preferred wave number of a target, then what we find is it should be QC minus some slope times epsilon, and what we find out is it's increased quite well with Wu and Catton, but of course there's quite some variability in this data. You know, this could be, who knows. It turns out the larger cells are typically better, the smaller the cell gets, it's different. So the cell size goes from 1 is the largest to 4 is the smallest. Okay, well so then we asked ourselves, can we understand spiral dynamics? Actually, half of the story I've already told you. I told you that if I have a target which doesn't have the right wave number, it will try to adjust its wave number as to reach this selected wave number QT. Okay? But now we have to ask ourselves, what about this dislocation? We have, after all, we have these two dislocations, and we ask ourselves, what do these dislocations do? And to analyze this quantitatively, for example, to measure this target wave number, the underlying target wave number, what we have to do is, or spiral wave number, what we want to do is, we want to know what is for dislocation. The dislocation moves in some type of pattern or background wave number. It could be the averaged wave number or something. This dislocation sees the surrounding wave number. How can we determine that wave number? So one method to do this is you just take one of these spirals and average it over time. And this came to a surprise to us because we were used to think about Archimedean spirals, and if you take an Archimedean spiral, it averages away to zero. There's nothing left. But it turns out if you have two dislocations, then it's not true anymore. And you can show this even mathematically. I'm not going to show you the calculation. I'm going to show you just some pictures. This also works for off-center spirals. So here's an off-center one-arm spiral. The off-center one-arm spiral will actually, this defect will go slow out here, and then it will speed up where the pattern is compressed and go slow again. So here's just different pictures. They're taken at, it says down here, at the different times. And this is the average picture, and again, we find actually a target, an off-center target, which means we know what the wave number is the dislocation sees when it runs around this target, or the spiral. Now, just to explain why, visually explain to you why we get a target and not a spiral, and not nothing, when we average the spiral. Here what we have done is we have taken the underlying target and the spiral and we added them both up. Does it make sense? So where the target and the spiral are the same, we just get black, white, black, white, black, white. Where the target and the spiral are out of phase, we get gray. And so what that shows you is that for this rotating spiral, which goes around like this one on spiral, the whole phase deformation is all localized in this region. So again, what we have done is we just have added up the spiral and the target, and where the phase deformation happens, the pattern turns to be gray. So what you can do also is you can look at this for the spiral, which speeds up and slows down. So this is the slow region. The phase deformation is here. Then the spiral speeds up. And the interesting thing is the phase deformation, since the defect speeds up over here, the core is kind of left behind. So it looks like this. And now it has sped up. You know, it's very fast. So now the deformation looks like this. And then over here, the deformation actually looks all the way, goes all the way to here. So this is how the picture really looks when I add up all these pictures. And because this jumps only a little bit, at the end I end up with a target. But there's this line, and I don't think we don't really understand why, what the behavior is of this situation, how the coupling actually is between the core and this dislocation out here. And I will not explain that because we don't know how it is. All we know is what I want to do now is just look at this dislocation and consider it as if it is in a target pattern. Okay, well, just to show you the wave numbers again, so this is the Busse balloon, this is epsilon, that's Q, and this is when we go up, for example, so this is the first target instability, this is the second target instability, so this is the blinker, this is when the pattern tears up and makes, so this is the wave number span of our off-center target before the pattern tears and makes a one-arm spiral, and this is just the wave number of a one-arm spiral, and then the one-arm spiral also goes off-center and generates a compression on one side, a dilation on the other side. And then the pattern breaks up into a spiral defect chaos. Or it could go from a one-arm spiral to a three-arm spiral, which we also observe. Not in this case. And again, this is just showing you what the span of wave numbers is that we measure actually in the location of the dislocation. Right, where the dislocation goes around, that's where we have measured that wave number. Okay. Well, what you can then do is you measure the tip velocity of the spiral, which is this outer dislocation, and what you find is that the velocity is linear in epsilon, and it doesn't depend on cell size. Well, since there are cells different at different radii, what that means is the frequencies are different, but the velocities are approximately all the same. That means if I make a system infinitely large, the frequency of rotation will be zero, which is very different from these reaction diffusion spirals. Actually, it goes like 1 over r. And so what we find out is that the period of rotation goes like 1 over the system size, and I could have shown you some other data, and if we time average the spiral, we get an underlying target. So the question is, what determines the spiral rotation? I've already given you some hints. And what is the topological condition for rotation? Oops. And so let's just look at the one-arm spiral again. So here's the one-arm spiral. We have this defect here. It moves through the defect velocity Vd, and we have outward traveling waves omega r. Only in this situation, the dislocation has to go around once by 2 pi. When it has gone around 360 degrees, there just is one roll has traveled out from the core. So that relates the traveling speed of this underlying target to the velocity of this dislocation. So what we can do is we can just calculate the frequency, and then if we have a rigid rotation, that means the outward frequency is going to be the frequency of rotation, and that's all there we need. This is just necessary to have a spiral that is stationary. And then what we want to ask ourselves is, let me go back first, we ask ourselves, can we say something about this Vd? And so there was lots of works by Desauer and Cross mainly, and what they predicted is that far enough above threshold, what you can find is that the velocity of the dislocation is proportional to a difference of wave numbers. So in other words, there is a velocity at which, there's a wave number at which the velocity is equal to zero. So at Q equals QD, the dislocations don't move. If I change the wave number, then we get a velocity. It either moves one way or it moves the other way. Now the question is this correct? These were calculations mostly from phase diffusion equations and from like Swift-Homberg equations with mean flow, and the question is that correct? And the answer is yes, we can check this experimentally because we have an off-center spiral. By having an off-center spiral, we know that the dislocation goes slow over here and then it speeds up over there. At the same time, we can average the spiral and calculate the background wave number. Now we can measure the velocity as a function of wave number while we are going around. And so if we do that, here's the picture. So what we can do is we can do some technique. These little crosses here are the locations of the dislocation as a function of time. So they're equal times. And what you see is the dislocation is fast over here, slow over there. Then we can average this, and then we can calculate the wave number of the pattern. And then what we can do is we can plot, of course, the wave number as a function of time in over here. And we can plot the velocity as a function of time. Of course, what's interesting is to plot the velocity as a function of wave number, defect wave number. And what we find out is this is actually the defect wave number. It's just Q at the location of this location. So what we find out, it's linear, which is exactly what the theory had predicted. The theory said that the velocity should be proportional to Q minus a preferential wave number. And the preferential wave number is where this thing goes through zero. And so what we can do is we can check this relationship, and what we find out is that the defect velocity is going to be beta times Q minus QD, and we can plot QD versus epsilon, and we can plot beta, this coefficient here, versus epsilon, and we can also do large-scale numerical simulations of a parallel roll pattern, not spirals, just a parallel roll pattern, and compare these two properties, and we find out that indeed approximately it is also correct in the numerical simulations. Of course, the data, it might not be 100% right, but it's a very good approximation to the data. I'll show you some more data at the end. So now the question is, what is the spiral rotation? Well, you already know it. The rotation will be quite simple. We have the target selection, and we have the defect selection, and they both compete. And, well, this is basically here. We had the traveling wave frequency had to be equal to the defect frequency of rotation. And if I have an M-arm spiral, well, for an M-arm spiral, we now have four dislocations. So this means we are annihilating four rolls when we go around. Right? So we have to put in the topological charge, so to speak, of our system. It's M equals 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and so on. And so if you put this together, what we find is that we have this relationship now, that the frequency of the traveling wave has to be m times the number of dislocation frequencies. And then if also we know the phase equation. We have done this before. We know that the rotation rate is going to be some coefficient alpha times qt minus q over r, where r is the location of the dislocation going around on this circle. And if we set this equal, we find out that m times the defect velocity should be equals to alpha times qt minus q. And so where QT is the optimal target wave number, and we can check all this, and what we do is you ask yourself, well, how do we know what the target wave number for a spiral is? Well, what we do is we do an extrapolation. So we measure it at smaller epsilons where we have targets. We have this linear line. We make an linear extrapolation into the region where the spiral is active, and that gives us QT. And we know Q, and we know VD, and so we can just measure everything. We can measure this alpha, and so this is the measurements for alpha. So this is about four. This is a four-arm spiral. These are two-arm spirals here. These ones are one-arm spirals. And these are, we think, are finite size deviations. In other words, when the spirals are too small a system, they are compressed. This is the prediction from the Eckhaus analysis. So when I take the Eckhaus instability at QT, then I can calculate what alpha should be from the phase diffusion equation, and they both agree pretty well. Okay? And it shows, you know, some system size dependence, but which we don't understand, but that's just how it is. So we can summarize this first part of the talk, and so what we have here is, again, so this is the Busse balloon. Inside the Busse balloon, we have the targets. We have the one-arm spirals. All that's shown here is one-arm spirals and four-arm spirals results. So So this is the wave number of the one-arm spiral. This is the wave number of the four-arm spiral. This is the wave number of the target. And this is the velocity of the dislocation. So this Q defect, this optimal velocity where the dislocation would stop, is over here. So what happens is basically this. We have a target that the target would like to go. So this is a four-arm spiral. This underlying target would like to go here. But the defects would like to go there. And so it's this competition of these two effects that pin the pattern exactly at this position, and everything agrees quantitatively and works out very well. So the phase diffusion predictions actually work almost quantitatively to describe the behavior in the system, which is, I find, convinces, always excites me, because it comes from a very general formula which does not include very strongly the mean flow effects other than in the defect motion. It does not include this whole off-center business, that everything is off-center. Right? That's not in this analysis. It's a solution that's in the far field of the dislocation. So I have another 10 minutes, roughly? Okay. Good. So what I just showed you is that we have this QD where the dislocation is stationary in this Bousset balloon, and we had this formula that the velocity of the dislocation was some constant beta, some coefficient beta of epsilon, times Q minus QD. And now what one may ask is, what determines QD? And what is the Prandtl number dependence? Just to remind you, the Prandtl number is a measure of the importance of the nonlinear term in the Navier-Stokes equation with respect to the heat equation. For Prandtl number 1, which we have here, they're roughly of equal importance. And what I now want to address is, you know, what determines this QD, and can we say something about the Prandtl number dependence? If I have an infinite Prandtl number, then these mean flow effects go away. They're very weak. If I have a very small Prandtl number, the mean flow is strong, and I will show you exactly again what it means. So here is a dislocation, and now I can do a numerical simulation. Actually, it's very hard to measure the mean flow, this vertical vorticity field, which is in the plane of the layer, which is a Poisson profile. It's very hard to measure that experimentally, because you always look down at the experiment and average, and the signal has the wrong symmetry. It averages away. So what we see here is the mean flow. So here's a dislocation. And what you find out is that the mean flow is always such as to move this dislocation into the rolled pattern. So this is the mean flow around one of these dislocations. And so what one would conjecture is that the mean flow, what one could think of is that this mean flow actually advects this dislocation along. And at the same time, we have some potential effects. We have a free energy. If there wouldn't be a mean flow, for example, if you take just Swift-Thunberg without mean flow, then that has a potential. And there's something called the Peach-Kühler force, which just says that the dislocation will move in such a way as to minimize the potential. So we have two effects. We have the mean flow, and we have the Peach-Kühler force. And now we want to figure out what is that. And so you can do this in two ways. You can, on the one side, you can use the Navier-Stokes equation, the Businesky equations. On the other hand, you can take the generalized Swift-Thunberg equation, which I've written down here. So that equation basically is made up of the normal Swift-Thunberg equation, which has a potential, plus a mean flow vertical vorticity contribution. So this psi is like the mid-plane temperature of the system. It's been advected by a velocity, which is given by a potential psi, and there's a second equation, which is the mean flow equation, and the important part here is there's this factor g, which just goes like 1 over the Prandtl number. If you remember that, that's all you need. So the smaller the Prandtl number, the larger the mean flow effects will be, right? Because the larger g is. And so we have a potential part and a non-potential part, we have, so to speak, and what we can do is we can do a simulation. So if we now simulate very carefully, it turns out it's quite tricky, simulate dislocations and look at this function C and this function U, what we find out is the following. If we go along this line here, what we find is that C varies like this. So I just go along this line, and I see that C just jumps like that. And now if I change this G, so I change 1 over Prandtl number, I change the factor G, what I realize is that this function doesn't seem to change much. That doesn't mean we understand why it doesn't change much. All this is an experimental observation, a numerically experimental observation that says, well, this is how it is. So this is very nice. So this function doesn't seem to change, which you will see in a moment is nice in the analysis. Another thing we can plot is we can now plot also the UI velocity along this line, which again, but this time we scale it with the Prandtl number of its 1 over g. So we normalize it by g. And then again, what we find is dependent on g varied from 2.5 to 20, there's very little variation in this functional form. Okay? So what that means is if we divide our u by g, then we get a universal functional form along this direction y. And if we take psi just directly, it also is kind of a universal shape. But what we can do is we can put this in the equation. So we go along this line. So what we do is we take the equation we had before, which has a mean flow term and the potential part. We go in the moving frame of the dislocation. And then what we do is we just consider this equation along this line y. And so if we do that, we know that our function uy is just g times some universal function f. And so what we do is we just put that in and we just integrate this equation over y. And if you do that, you see that there is just a constant contribution, which is the potential contribution. Then we have this part over here, which just comes in right here. And here's the mean flow part, which you can write down like this. And so what we find is that the velocity is going to be proportional to g with some constants, c1, c3, c2, c3. And then what we also know is that the average uy over this line is just the integral over fy times g, which is just a constant because the function is universal, times g. And so what this means is we can write now our velocity as a velocity at g equals 0 because it was the potential contribution plus a prefactor, which will depend on the wave number of the mean wave number that we have in the pattern, times the velocity, the mean flow velocity ui. So what that shows you is that the velocity of the dislocation can really be understood approximately as a superposition of two effects. One is the potential effect. In other words, the pattern would like to squeeze out the dislocation to reach its best wave number. On the other side, there's the mean flow, which would like to push in the dislocation into the system. And so we have these two effects. And so what we can do is we can test this numerically. So here's the velocity as a function of g for different wave numbers, and it's nicely linear in this generalized Swiss-Tonberg equation. Now you can also do this in Rayleigh-Benard convection. So for example here, here's the velocity versus 1 over Prandtl number for 1q. And again, it's a nice linear line, which means that this technique works. And then here's just the selection of qd, which shows that the velocity is proportional to q. So we have shown... This was the full, yes, this is the full Businessky equation. That's no experiment, no. No, because you would have to really vary the Prandtl number, right? Now this, everything since the beginning of the defect part is all numerical. The only thing we've measured is this. This is measured. So the selected QD, Q, this part has been measured. This part we haven't measured because we have only one Prandtl number. Okay, well now there was this surprising discovery when I was working in Günther's lab quite a few years ago. And what we had discovered was a huge spiral that was rotating, and there were two dislocations which were stuck. They would go around the experiment for hours, and they would never annihilate. So in other words, there was a bound pair of dislocations. Now this, I think it was published in this paper in 92, and so we had this case, and we never really understood what that is. But now it makes sense. It actually turns out, when you do this analysis more carefully, you find out that this dislocation is now advected. So if you go close to the case where the pattern would come to halt, because there the potential effect is equal to the mean flow effect, the dislocation would just stop, right? If you're at that point, that would be QD. But if I move off a little bit, the dislocation still moves. But a small modification in the mean flow will be enough to stop the dislocation because it's not advected. So what happens is, and it turns out it's even quantitative, you can superimpose these two mean flows and calculate the effective mean flow, and you can predict when the dislocation should stop. So in other words, the dislocation moves up, driven by mean flow, against the potential effect. The potential effect is this way. So it moves up, it's being advected. The other dislocation comes closer, the two mean flows are opposing each other, they weaken, then the potential effect is strong enough to keep it apart. So it just reaches this equilibrium and you get bound dislocation pairs, and we think this is the explanation of these bound dislocation pairs. And I'm done. 5 minutes, okay? You have lots of time for questions. And so what we have seen is that the potential moves the dislocations towards the bend center. It always wants to increase the wave number. The bend center is approximately QC, which is the middle of the Spuse balloon. The mean flow wants to decrease the wave number. It always wants to eject the dislocation out of the system. It just wants to get rid of it, which means it moves to the other side of the Spuse balloon. So if we have this epsilon versus Q system here, then here is approximately QC. Now there's this line. So this is what the potential effect would approximately select. And the dislocation, the defect, always wants to move the system over here. And when these two effects are equal, we get this line QD, which is over here. And when I'm close to this line, then I find these bound dislocation pairs. Because then the system, the mean flows can overlap, and I find again an equilibrium between these two dislocations, and the dislocations are bound. Okay, well let me close with this movie, which is something that Steve knows very well, Steve Morris and Günther and I. And so this is spiral defect chaos, which we published in 1992, and now you look at the state and you say, well, what is it? Well, what you realize is there are lots of spirals. But these spirals are not giant. Well, they're actually quite large, but they're not on center. They usually have all very, very strong dynamics. And actually, if you watch these, what you often see is that these spirals have this off-center motion of this pinching that I showed in the first movie, where the spiral just keeps going and starts to pinch and pinch and pinch. That is happening in the system. And then we have, you know, other effects, and I leave you just looking at this a little bit to realize how little we actually know about spirals. Because all we have done is we have on-center or slightly off-center spirals. We know that they go unstable at a certain wave number when the spiral has compressed the pattern enough to tear. But we have nothing, we can say nothing about the interaction of these many dislocations of the spirals. We have very, very little understanding of the system here. And I actually would like to leave that as a challenge to the mathematicians to help us in explaining a phenomenon like this. What's promising is that phase equations have helped us to understand these spiral dynamics. So to me, this pattern actually is mostly phase dynamics. But then there's also all these amplitude zeros and all these dislocations, and I just don't know how to handle that. And I would be wonderful if we can do this. In the meantime, you know, we can make very large systems. We can run this. I think Günther ran this system the longest, 3 months? Approximately, and it's not a transient. It stays around. If you're willing to wait 3 months, it will stay around for 3 months. So this is an interesting state, and I think we are making leeway in understanding it. We actually do not fully understand this blinking in the middle. I could have put it in my talk. We did a Kahuya-Levy decomposition of the core motion, and it turns out you need like 3 modes, and that describes the dancing motion. But that doesn't really mean we understand it. It just means we know how to describe it. So there's lots left to do, and just let me close there. Thank you.